Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
With Hurricane Rita barreling down on the Texas coast, mandatory evacuation orders are in place for Corpus Christi and Galveston. We'll touch down there later in the program. But first to Houston, where evacuation is still voluntary. Dr. Paul Sirba is director of the Emergency Center at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. Now, we spoke with him 2 weeks ago while he cared for evacuees from Katrina in the Astrodome and in Houston's shelters. Today, Dr. Sirba is at the emergency room at Texas Children's, making his own preparations for the storm, and he joins us. Dr. Sirba, I understand that there are 450 patients and their families at Texas Children's right now. What's the plan?
Well, I think we are trying to evacuate those that we can, and we have some evacuation plans for our ventilated patients, some of our ventilated patients, some of our ICU patients, some of our NICU patients. But a lot of the patients are going to stay here, and a lot of their families are actually in the hospital with them. Some of the parents have taken off to other areas around the state, and we're keeping in contact with them to make sure they're well aware of the condition of their kids.
You know, we saw pictures of children on ventilators and preemies being carefully evacuated from Galveston and perhaps from Houston as well. But I wonder, I mean, are some of your patients too sick to stay or too sick to go?
I think probably too sick to go, and we also don't have a lot of places to send them. We sort of filled up a couple weeks ago ourselves, and a lot of places around the city also, around the state also, kind of filled up their beds. But we have found some locations, and a lot of the ventilated patients are the healthy ventilated patients that are usually at home on a home ventilator, and there's concern with all of the traffic on the freeway that their batteries will run dead, and they won't be able to manage the child on the way to their evacuation city.
Sure.
So a lot of those parents came to our emergency department seeking shelter, and we took them in, and now we're trying to find places that they might be able to go while they ride out the storm.
Right. Well, we know at the hospital you have mattresses, you have food and water, but what about generators? We heard that many Houston hospitals lost their first-floor generators in previous storms. I mean, you know, who would have thought? And now they've moved them upstairs. Are you comfortable that you have enough generating for electricity?
Well, yeah. You know, the we were very fortunate. We opened up a new, basically an entire upper floor and a new building at Texas Children's just before Allison. So we actually had generators high enough that they weren't flooded or affected. Plus, we had flood doors that were successfully closed. And so our hospital was one of the few hospitals in the Texas Medical Center that was actually fully operational during Allison.
Hmm.
So we got adults and kids during that time period. So we're, you know, you just never know, and we're not counting on anything, and we're preparing for everything.
Hmm.
But we're hopefully, you know, we're all confident that we'll have the same situation, that we'll have power, and that we'll have water and all of the necessary things. We have lots of food.
Well,
we're just hoping we're going to be able to ride this thing through.
Well, you don't have, for instance, the levee concern that they had in New Orleans, but, you know, you certainly might have the wind concerns. What is the plan? Do patients get wheeled into the halls away from windows?
They're all, you know, this is a constantly fluid situation, and everybody's making changes as we think we need to. And, of course, that is always a concern because most patient rooms have windows. So I'm sure the ones that do have windows, and if they're on the side of the wind that there's a concern, I'm sure they'll be moved either into the hallways or other beds. We have plans to do some downward evacuation later on in today into the tomorrow, where actually as we kind of empty out our hospital, we're going to start bringing people from the higher floors down to the lower floors. And we always have those higher floors if we need them to expand later on, and, you know, after the storm passes. But I think our hope is to keep them away from the windows and to keep them lower, just in case we have to evacuate. It'll be a little easier. We learned a lot from Allison, and one of the things we learned was the fact that, you know, you want to get them out as fast as you can and not have 14 flights of stairs to carry people down. So.
And Dr. Sirba, in the minute we have, you have your own life. Have you had personal concerns, family concerns?
Family concerns. I'm a caregiver with my mother, and luckily for me, I have a sister that flew down last night, and she picked her up, and we dropped her off at the airport this morning at 7. So my sister and my sitter and my mom are on their way to Maryland.
Yeah, but I know you've had friends who've had a newborn, and they're staying at the hospital, and people are having to make these decisions. They've had to send their children away?
they sent their children with friends out of town, and they are going to stay here with their newborn baby.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of families in that situation here.
Having to make these decisions. Well, Dr. Paul Sierba, he's the director of the Emergency Center at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, awaiting Rita's landfall, which could be Friday night or Saturday. Thanks very much for speaking with us, and good luck to you.
Keep us in your prayers.
We will. Well, now to the question, is there a war on science? An editorial in this week's New England Journal of Medicine blasts the Food and Drug Administration for rejecting its own advisory panel's recommendation that emergency contraception, called Plan B or the morning after pill, be made available over the counter. Now, making the morning after pill available without a time-consuming doctor's prescription is a move most scientists and physicians call critical in safely preventing unwanted pregnancies. The editorial says the FDA never provided evidence to support its contention that the pill presents a health risk. So what's going on? Well, Chris Mooney, author of the just-released The Republican War on Science, says the move is another example of the Bush administration distorting scientific evidence to advance conservative, right-wing Christian ideals masquerading as science. It's pretty provocative, and Chris joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And before we branch out to the issues in general that you talk about in the book, let's talk about Plan B.
Sure.
What does this story illustrate for you? Again, the FDA overturning its own advisory panel's recommendation.
What's really interesting here is that Christian conservatives or social conservatives don't want this drug more widely available. It's pretty clear that the FDA is catering to them. The FDA has cooked up a questionable scientific rationale for catering to them. Rather than supporting their political or moral agenda, the FDA is pretending that it has a scientific reason for slowing down approval. But in fact, the scientific reason has been rejected by all the scientific advisors.
And the scientific reason again?
They're claiming that they need more data on how the drug will be used by young adolescents. And of course, if you talk to the scientists, they'll say, well, we have no reason to think that there'll be any problem with them. And we don't do this with other drugs. We don't break out different age groups like this and create distinctions that way. Why the special pleading in this case? And the answer is they had to come up with some scientific-sounding reason to slow things down.
Well, now, let's play devil's advocate. Isn't it possible that advisory committee members such as author W. David Hager, who wrote the book As Jesus Cared for Women, he was one of the four who voted against making the morning-after pill available over the counter. Might he not genuinely have a concern about young girls buying the morning-after pill without parents knowing it?
Well, he may have a moral concern, but the FDA is not supposed to be setting our cultural values. The FDA is a science-based agency that judges drugs based on safety and effectiveness.
Tell us about that shift, people who oppose certain contraceptions, certain sciences based on moral or ethical reasons, shifting to a scientific language to express that.
This is part of what I would call the war on science. Why it grows increasingly insidious is because we have this concept of the Scopes trial and a grand clash between science and religion, and that may have been the way that things played out in 1925 on the evolution issue. But now, in fact, religious conservatives often claim that they have their own version of science that they use to combat mainstream conclusions. So they say that intelligent design is a scientific alternative to evolution. They say that adult stem cell research is a scientific alternative to embryonic stem cell research. And on Plan B contraception, they have their, quote, scientific reason for opposing approval. So they're misusing science rather than denying it outright. And so a lot of confusion is created.
Confusion, but also some successes. We're going to talk more about the history of this shift and when and how it came to be in a moment. But first, give me some more examples of what you think the FDA story illustrates in a broader sense.
Sure. Well, I think it illustrates the fact that we cannot, at this moment, rely necessarily on these federal government agencies to make decisions in the public interest using science.
And as you've said, science is not a democracy.
Certainly not. Science is a process in which knowledge advances cumulatively by being viewed critically, but eventually, as certain ideas persist and withstand criticism, they become established. And there's nothing, you don't vote on that. Rather, it's merit. It's the merit of the idea, and it's how strongly it withstands criticism.
Well, let's get some examples. You charge the Bush administration with a pattern of anti-scientific behavior that includes the suppression of information, targeting individual scientists whose studies contradict either the Bush administration goals or those of the supporters of the administration, and using error and misrepresentation, probably knowingly. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Well, let's talk about suppression first. With the Bush administration, there's a great example. The White House tried to change the content of an Environmental Protection Agency report that discussed climate change, and the EPA released a memo saying, this doesn't represent the scientific consensus anymore. They're trying to take out references by the National Academy of Sciences. So political people are going in and, if not suppressing a report outright, trying to doctor the contents. And that's a clear, flagrant violation of the integrity of the scientific process going on in federal agencies.
How about targeting scientists? You write that the doctor who wrote the WHO's report on diet and obesity was targeted.
Sure.
Why? Why would somebody be politically against a report on obesity and diet?
Well, because it has political ramifications for the food industry. I mean, this is a World Health Organization report, and governments might decide how they're going to set food policy. They might decide to impose taxes on unhealthy foods to try to steer people towards eating more healthy foods. They might, in this country, you know, maybe take soft drinks out of schools or something like this. So there's a clear interest in the part of some food companies of questioning some of the science that might link their products to the U.S. obesity epidemic.
Error and misrepresentation.
Sure.
You open the book with a reminder of President Bush speaking of 60 stem cell lines.
More than 60, he said, on August 9, 2001, when he announced his stem cell policy to the nation. And scientists pretty quickly said, what 60 lines. We're not familiar with this, and it turns out to have been at best based on confusion. You would expect the president to vet scientific information carefully before he bases a policy on it, but apparently that didn't happen in this case. And furthermore, you would expect if the president makes a mistake that he would apologize and maybe revisit the policy, but that didn't happen either.
And why would the president or his speechwriters or supporters want to say there were more stem cell lines than there
were? Well, this was key to the president's policy. Remember, he wanted to give the impression that he was brokering a compromise and he was going to allow significant research to go forward while not allowing any research on newly derived lines. That was where he drew his moral line in the sand. And so that more than 60 number made it sound like he was allowing a lot of research to go forward. So it was actually quite crucial.
Well, Chris Mooney, isn't the left also guilty at times of, you know, sloganeering instead of science?
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's not that anyone is completely innocent. It's rather that one side is more guilty, if that makes sense. And so, sure, let's call out Democrats for misusing science, and I've been willing to do that in the past. And one example on the stem cell issue, John Edwards during the 2004 presidential campaign, he said, if you vote for John Kerry and I, people like Christopher Reeve will get out of their wheelchairs and walk again. And that's quite outrageous statement that you cannot justify based on the science, because it's very basic research in embryonic stem cell work, and we don't know what specific diseases we may ultimately be able to cure. And scientists are very cautious about this, and Edwards wasn't. So that's misusing science, I think. But I think what we're seeing now from the Bush administration and the right, much more comprehensive, many more issues, much more serious.
And the power to implement.
Right, and they run the whole government.
That's Chris Mooney, his new book, The Republican War on Science. Well, his critics say, oh, yeah? What about Galileo? Wasn't there a time when fringe scientists were right? And also, was it always this way? Didn't mainstream scientists once roam the halls of Republican White Houses? Stay with us. We've got much more ahead here and now. The author of the book, The Republican War on Science, what he sees as a clash between conservative ideals and science, in the Bush administration in particular. And Chris, you've presented examples of how the Republican right has developed an adversarial relationship with the mainstream scientific community. But I'm thinking it wasn't always this way. A Republican founded the U.S. branch of the World Wildlife Fund. Scientists once roamed the halls of the White House. They had the president's ear. You're nodding, yes. So what happened?
Eisenhower was a Republican president who was responsible for bringing science advice into the White House during the Sputnik crisis, when it was feared that we were falling behind the Soviets in technology. And, you know, this carried on. It was bipartisan through the Kennedy administration. And, you know, the falling off, I think, began probably when Nixon threw the scientists out of the White House because he didn't like what they were saying about the supersonic transport program, right, the high-speed passenger jet, which was a hot issue at the time. Unfortunately, you know, as all this is happening, the modern conservative movement is gathering steam and taking control of the Republican Party. And around the time that Reagan comes into power, we really have a president who's a Republican who is catering to the modern conservative movement and its key constituencies, big business, religious conservatives, who will only become more powerful in later years in the Republican Party. And it's these groups who really want the science to go their way on key issues.
Well, tell us a little more about that, because there was a determined effort, in fact, to create the think tanks that would create the scientists that would back the science.
Right. And that's one of the reasons that the problem has gotten so bad is that, especially since the 70s, conservatives have focused on generating their own sources of scientific expertise in quotes, that is often friendly to their political predispositions. So you get the creation of a wide variety of think tanks. If we do global warming, for example, then you have the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which has been attacking a prominent report on climate change, the National Assessment of Climate Change, talking about what it will do to the different parts of the United States. On evolution, you get the same thing, which is the Seattle-based Discovery Institute is leading the attack on evolution. And this is a think tank which has a sort of conservative religious right kind of orientation to it.
And some of the think tanks that have become, you know, conservative mainstream started with this idea in mind of generating new science, new experts, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute.
Yes, there are really many, and you can trace the growth. And so I think that this trend of creating a counter academia, if you will, the right's alternative to universities, because, of course, scientific expertise is coming from universities.
What's wrong with someone firmly believing in something and saying, ah, I know how this works. I have to get a science expert on my side, and I have to get a think tank on my side because I don't think it's balanced.
Right. So nothing wrong with the first thing you said, which is someone firmly believing something. What is wrong is a politician appointing him or herself to be the judge of what's good science and what's bad, because we don't want our politicians to be scientists. We want good channels of communication between politicians and scientists so politicians are informed. And if the politicians go around cherry-picking who their experts are going to be or what information they're going to use, then the channels of communication are corrupted.
As you write, ideologues rarely relinquish an idea, but scientists have to.
You know, eventually reality will force itself upon you. You can't deny it forever.
Right.
I mean, and that's what we're going to see on something like global warming.
Well, you know, speaking of global warming, you're from New Orleans.
That's right.
Born and raised?
I wasn't born there, but I grew up there.
Yeah. And you wrote an article, much like the much-discussed National Geographic article of 2004 that warned of what might happen in the aftermath of a storm like Katrina. What do you think happened? I mean, you told Terry Gross on Fresh Air that only your brother listened to your warning.
So far as I can tell.
Right.
Yeah.
But is there any evidence of anyone actively undermining that opinion, as you detailed in the book people have done about other issues?
No.
Or was it just not paying attention?
You know, I know of no evidence suggesting any sort of concerted campaign to undermine knowledge about the vulnerability of New York. Like, I think that there has been a campaign to undermine knowledge about global warming or about evolution. Don't see that on the New Orleans issue. We had scientists who were very worried about the vulnerability of New Orleans, and someone like myself could go and interview them, and politicians could too, but somehow, no, it wasn't triggering any action. They were just being ignored. And, you know, I think that the analogy with the war on science that I'm describing is in another place, which is that in the wake of Katrina hitting, we saw a terrible failure by the government to respond, and specifically by FEMA. And it really called into question the competence of FEMA to use emergency management expertise to serve the public, which is its goal and job and duty. And that's true of a lot of these other agencies that are also expert agencies in the Bush administration now, where science has been so corrupted in a lot of cases that we have to question whether they're using science to serve the public interest. So the FDA, Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, you know, are they using science to serve the public interest, or are they just willing to put a spin on it in response to the way they're being lobbied by special interests that the administration wants to cater to?
Well, let me ask you something else on science before we let you go, especially being from New Orleans. When I was in that area recently of the Gulf, all the locals were saying, the water's so hot. It had reached this sort of mythic legend status. It's so hot. And they believe that the water has, you know, heated up so much that it has to be global warming that's causing these, you know, the highest record of hurricanes in recent memory. Right. What do you think about global warming and the hurricanes?
Well, we have to be cautious here. We know global warming is happening. We know humans are causing it, and it's going to lead to a lot of things, and rising ocean temperatures are certainly one of them.
I have to back you up. You say we know this to be true, but again, the Bush administration has not signed on to that thinking.
Well, they've sought to undermine it in a lot of different ways, whether it's the president talking about uncertainty without talking about what we actually know. It's just sort of selectively using uncertainty, to the White House editing scientific documents at EPA. They've clearly tried to undermine public knowledge of the global warming threat. But when you get into global warming and hurricanes, there is some controversy. The first thing you have to acknowledge up front is that you cannot say that global warming caused any particular storm or that it didn't. But what you can start to study, and what scientists are starting to study, is whether global warming causes more intense storms on average. And that would seem to fit the theory, right? If the ocean is warmer, then the storms will draw power from a warmer ocean and might become stronger. And so you have studies coming out now that are making that connection. And this is going to continue to be debated, but it's certainly on the table right now.
But is this where the left would also make a mistake by running forward and saying, it's global warming, we have hurricanes?
They should be cautious. They should be cautious here because they don't want to be susceptible to the same criticism.
Chris Mooney, author of the newly released The Republican War on Science. Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
Then a million residents in Texas and Louisiana are under orders to evacuate their homes as Hurricane Rita closes in. Rita has weakened a bit, but might still be an extremely dangerous hurricane by the time it makes landfall later tomorrow or early Saturday. And as we said earlier, Galveston, Texas is one of the Gulf Island communities under order to evacuate. T.J. Olds is mainland editor for the Galveston County Daily News. And TJ, we spoke with you yesterday. The front page of your paper today has a picture of several buses headed north out of town, off the island. Are people still leaving?
Yeah, they are. And the traffic flow down on this end of the evacuation route is actually moving along pretty good. It is when you get up into Houston and trying to get out, it is total gridlock right now. And that's the big thing that's happening as folks are trying to get out. It's getting extremely frustrating. But the state Department of Transportation just announced that starting with the main thoroughfare out, Interstate 45, they're going to open up all lanes head north now.
Well, we understand that all officials, local, state, federal, who are watching from the sidelines, are being extra cautious, especially because of Katrina, but also because of, you know, the strength of Rita, at least now. What else are you seeing? We've been seeing pictures of evacuations of newborns, for instance, from hospitals.
Yeah, all the hospitals, for example, in Galveston County were cleared out yesterday, along with all the assisted living and nursing homes. Now you're starting to see that happen in Houston.
And TJ, remind us, how close is Houston to Galveston, and how close is Houston to the coast?
Yeah, it is 60 miles up the road from Galveston. So, you know, anything that affects Galveston weather-wise like that definitely affects Houston as well.
I hear it sounds like you're still monitoring television and other reports. Do you expect that you will lose electricity? I was speaking to some people in Florida who said that, for instance, on the Marco Island, they have their electricity shut off by officials when it gets this close to a storm. What do you think is going to happen in your area?
In this area, in particular, in the building we're in, that probably is not going to be the case. This is a building that was built for a Category 5 storm that would be coming through here and has its own backup power generator that's elevated off the ground. But the rest of the county is in dire trouble of losing the power. No, the city officials have not said that they would cut off power to anyone who didn't evacuate or anything like that. They have said, though, they're not going to provide other services, such as you call 911 saying you need help. They're just not going to be able to help you.
Well, then how many people are staying? Do you have a sense?
At this point, no. I think we're seeing the vast majority of folks are getting out.
I know you sent most of your staff home. When are you going?
I stay here, myself and then Marty Schladen, who's another one of our reporters, and we have a couple of photographers with us. So we're not going anywhere. We're staying put.
Well, as you said, you're in a building built to sustain a Category 5 hurricane.
Yeah, it's a new building, too.
I was going to say, has it ever been tested?
we're going to christen it. So I sure hope the county engineer knew what he was doing.
Well, good luck to you. T.J. Olds, mainland editor of the Galveston County Daily News. Well, federal, state, and local officials say they have learned the lesson of Katrina. They are prepared for Hurricane Rita as it approaches land. On the CBS Early Show, Admiral Larry Herath said the federal government is well connected with Texas state officials.
I think the communication between our organizations to make sure that we put people and processes and equipment in place to prevent and minimize damage and then respond to any damage that we assess afterwards is the important key.
Joining us on the line now, USA Today reporter Mimi Hall, who's done a complete rundown of Rita preparations compared to Katrina preparations. And Mimi, you cite several major differences between the two evacuations, and the most important seems to be the timing.
Yeah, I think hindsight has obviously helped here. I mean, there's, you know, with the devastation from Katrina and the government's really poor response, they're really doing their best to get their act together. Now, this is a huge, huge storm, so we'll see how it comes out in the end. But right now, you know, they're trying to put in place a lot of the steps that they didn't ahead of time last time.
And that includes having this evacuation much earlier than the New Orleans evacuation.
That's right, and I think everybody saw what happened in New Orleans with, you know, a sixth of that city's residents had no way to get out of the city had they wanted to because they don't own cars, and the city didn't provide buses for them and get them out. And so this time they've ordered these evacuations 3 days ahead of time. A lot of the citizens are paying much more attention. They're hiring buses. They're clearing out nursing homes. They're helping those who can't get out on their own. So it seems to be a much better effort on that front this time.
What about on a federal level? What about FEMA? Have supplies been staged? Has there been better contact, as officials are saying there has been?
Well, they say there has, and they seem to all be talking to each other. FEMA has also taken some steps that I think it didn't take last time in terms of asking the military for a lot more help. A huge problem last time was that when all the communications were knocked out, in the first few days, nobody could talk to each other, and they've got the military in now pre-positioning these, you know, incredibly expensive communication systems that really only the military has.
And so they're going to stage not only the military, but we understand supplies are going to be staged around and in the area, as opposed to sort of hanging back until it's all over to see where people are needed.
Yeah, they're going to stage what they can. You know, certain things you can't set up lots and lots of tractor trailers full of food and water right where the eye of the storm is coming because they'll be wiped out. And they did do some staging last time, but I think they're doing more and in a more coordinated way this time.
We understand FEMA's asked the Defense Department to help put up a 2,500-bed hospital system, and that on the ground in Galveston, city officials took stock, as you write, of residents there. They went door to door to find out exactly who was going to need help getting out, so they have a list of those people.
That's right. They compiled a list of, they put together these citizen teams to find not only nursing home patients and that kind of thing, those types of people who can't get out on their own, but just people living in their own homes but who might be elderly, who might be on oxygen, who might not be able to drive or get out on their own. So they had this full list. And as of yesterday, they had 1,800 of those 2,000 people already out or on their way out of the city, which is... you know, a tremendous effort.
Well, Mimi Hall, one of the questions a lot of people have is, what about pets? We saw in New Orleans that people stayed home with their beloved pets rather than leave. What's happening in the Texas area?
Right. Well, at least in Galveston, I know the officials saw what happened there and decided to allow people to take their pets on the buses out of town, to let them know that they could have them in the shelters, and even in a lot of the hotels are allowing them, apparently. It's been a terrible situation in New Orleans. Not only did some residents not evacuate because they didn't want to leave their pets, but those who did and who were forced to leave their pets in the city, there are just a lot of animals who are there, who mm-hmm. are starving, who don't have food and water, and it's a very, very sad situation all the way around. So mm-hmm. they're hoping to avoid that this time.
Well, as you write, buses are sailing out of Galveston and away from the coast with birds and cats and dogs along with
right.
the people, and nobody, well, seems to mind. Mimi Hall, reporting for USA Today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The nomination of Judge John Roberts to be the 17th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court will head to the full Senate after today's vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The panel's 10 Republicans were unified in their support, as expected, but Democrats on the committee were divided. Here's Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
Judge Roberts is a man of integrity. I take him at his word that he does not have an ideological agenda. For me, a vote to confirm requires faith that the words he spoke to us have meaning. I take him at his word that he will steer the court to serve as an appropriate check on potential abuses of presidential power.
But Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy reached a different conclusion on Roberts.
For all the hoopla and razzle-dazzle in 4 days of hearings, there is precious little in the record to suggest that a Chief Justice John Roberts would espouse anything less than the narrow and cramped view that staff attorney John Roberts so strongly advocated in the 1980s.
Well, where do we go now? Jonathan Turley is professor of law at George Washington University Law School. He joins us now. And welcome back, as always, Professor.
Thank you.
And as we just heard, Democrats split on John Roberts, Senators Biden and Feinstein also saying they will not support him. How does that set the stage for the next nomination?
Well, it was very surprising to see Leahy's decision, particularly because Roberts failed to give any answers whatsoever and when it came to substantive issues. And so many people are scratching their heads on exactly what Leahy heard in these answers. It's one thing to say, you know, you're not going to hold a nominee to answer. It's another to suggest that he did answer. And so there's a lot of, I think, bad feeling right now among the Democrats towards Leahy. What I think is most interesting is that Roberts is likely to sail through at this point. He'll have some opposition. But what was lost in this vote was an institutional the role for the Senate, that the Roberts model is a new model, and it's likely to be replicated in the future. Here the Senate, including the ranking member, Leahy, is saying that they will vote for a candidate who simply refuses to answer questions about basic views.
Well, and give us some context here, because we hear comparisons to other hearings, and it's been said that other hearings, I'm thinking of the Ginsburg hearing, did the same thing.
That's actually not true. I read the transcripts from the Ginsburg hearing. They were far more substantive. Indeed, I was on a panel last night with some of the advocates on the right, and they even admitted that the Ginsburg hearings were far more substantive than the Roberts hearing. There's no comparison to what happened in the Roberts hearing. There was literally nothing given to the Senate by Roberts.
Well, so given that template that you've laid out, that this Roberts hearing might have set a new precedent, what is the next set of hearings for the next nominee likely to be like? I mean, won't Democrats in particular fight back against that being the status?
Well, it's hard to see how someone like Leahy or the other Democrats could fight back. They have just indicated they're willing to accept a nominee who refuses to answer. And for them now to switch on the next nominee would appear just grossly hypocritical. It would occur so soon after they just approved precisely that type of candidate. So I think that the Democrats are unlikely to get traction on this. I mean, it has been remarkable how little cohesion or really coherence we've seen come out of the Democratic ranks.
Jonathan Turley, we've got about a minute left. Who do you think some of these nominees might be in the next set of hearings, and when is that going to be?
Well, it's going to be soon. I mean, the word on the street is that they've already made the decision. It's just that they're not releasing the name but that is expected to come soon. If they wanted a true Roberts clone, it would be someone like Diane Sykes in the Seventh Circuit, people who don't have a record, but they're essentially known only to God and the White House counsel. And, you know, someone like Sykes on the Seventh Circuit or Jeffrey Sutton on the Sixth Circuit follow the Roberts model. But many conservatives are pushing for a real red meat nominee to generate excitement among the conservative base.
Well, Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University Law School. These hearings were a bit overshadowed by, of course, the news of the hurricanes. We'll have to see, you know, what impact the news surrounding the hearings will have when the next ones come along. We'll hope to have you back when that happens.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for speaking with us. And thank you for being there. We'll be right back. More ahead here and now. Ansel Adams, and what images come to mind? Birch trees standing like elegant sentries, a full moon overlooking Yosemite Valley, lone witness to black and white. But Ansel Adams also photographed freeways and urban landscapes and made portraits of friends and photographs of Native American pueblos. Many of these rare photographs are in the Lane Collection. That's the largest holding of works by the artist still in private hands. And some of the highlights of the collection are now touring the country, beginning at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. We have a mini gallery of photographs on our website. You can go there, here-now.org. Well, we say hello to Karen Haas. She curated the exhibit, which is, as we said, now at the MFA here in Boston. Welcome, Karen.
Hi.
And we're also joined by collector Sandra Lane. She joined us as well. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
And thank you so much for sharing this collection with, first of all, us here in the city of Boston. I know that you and your late husband, William H. Lane, bought nearly 500 works directly from Ansel Adams?
That's correct.
And how would, first of all, how did that meeting come about?
Well, it's a little bit of a story. It started out that we acquired the Charles Sheeler collection, and Charles Sheeler knew Ansel and introduced Bill to him.
And Charles Sheeler, I have to interject, an artist, a photographer.
Yes.
And a character. May I read from the papers from the museum? It's from a letter that Charles wrote to your late husband.
Correct.
He just returned from a trip to Yosemite with Ansel Adams, and this is what he wrote. "This is it, the place where those who prefer our way of life may come, my America. I need a dictionary of adjectives to convey a glimpse of what I am seeing and feeling here. It's something I have not experienced before. The Yosemite is wonderful, as you have known, but I don't see anything I can do about it beyond putting my forehead to the earth in reverence. And this fellow Adams, there isn't enough I can say in his favor." So obviously, Mr. Sheeler was taken with Ansel Adams, and then you and your husband were as well.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Very much so. He opened another world, but my husband had flown over the country in an Army trainer in AT-6, and so he was very familiar with the country that Ansel Adams was photographing.
And what was it in the photo? I mean, you and your husband, I'm presuming, could have collected paintings.
Well, we did. Bill did before I met him. Modernism was our thing.
But what was it about the Ansel Adams photographs?
It was the wonders of America, and including people, buildings, Yosemite, whatever. Mm. He brought it closer to the people, I think, in reverence of it.
Well, Karen Haas, you've curated, as we said, these photos that Sandra has lent to the museum. Can you tell us what they tell us about Ansel Adams? Because some of them are from his teenage years.
Well, he begins as a young photographer really trying to find his way, completely self-taught, looking to earlier photographic styles, very self-consciously trying to make artistic photographs, finds his stride in the 1930s and 40s, and then really takes it and runs with it and makes the pictures that we, of course, know so well.
Give us an example of an early one where it's sort of contrived, you know, I'm going to make an artistic photo. What would be an example?
For example, there's a very early work called Wind, in which he's taken a juniper tree in Yosemite and made a very beautiful asymmetrical image, very, as I said, self-consciously artistic, soft focus, warm toned, very unlike the sharp-focused, very graphic black-and-white pictures that we think of him as doing later on.
Well, and I'm looking at one photograph. It's from about 1932. How old would he have been then?
30 years old.
Right, so he's maturing.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Rose and Driftwood. Now, Sandra, you mentioned as well that he had taken pictures of Georgia O'Keeffe. He was a friend of Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yes.
I'm looking at this picture, an open rose on a piece of driftwood. What else can you tell us about it?
Well, it just shows the sensitivity of Ansellata, who was always considered the outdoorsman and rough and ready, but he had a very tender side and a very sweet side to him.
And as I'm looking at this rose face on opening, I'm thinking of Georgia O'Keeffe. Who mm-hmm. influenced who?
I think it was really a very much a symbiotic relationship, a friendship that went back and forth. They both shared an interest in the transformation that takes place when someone gets very close to a subject. And he was using a large camera, and she was obviously using paint and canvas. But they had very similar interests, and they were modernists working at the same time.
And there is also on our website a photograph of Georgia O'Keeffe taken by Ansel Adams against this dark cloud, and she's got the black sort of sombrero hat on and a black coat pulled up under her chin from about 1937. Did he take many portraits?
He didn't take many, although he did take them over the course of his whole career. And that one's particularly interesting because it was made with a 35-millimeter camera, so it allowed it. That spontaneity.
Sandra, you and your husband, as we said, bought so many photographs from him. What was that process like? Did he say, I got a little something to show you? You know, with the briefcase?
No. We met here in Boston one day when he was visiting and working at Polaroid. And he said, well, you ever come out to Carmel, come see me. And Bill asked him and said, well, we will come out, but we'd like to make a collection of your work. And so right off, Ansel said, come on out. I'll show you everything I've got.
And when was this?
1967.
Yeah, so he hadn't yet become, you know, the poster on everybody's dorm wall.
No.
So lucky you.
And he literally, when we arrived, he said, there are the boxes. And go to it.
Oh, my gosh. What was he like? What was Ansel Adams like?
He was terrific. He was the best friend you'd ever want to have. He was ready for anything at any time, very giving, and always was sharing with students. In his Yosemite workshops, people would apply, and there would be like 30 students, and they'd really want to be in there, and he was very selective about who entered.
As we've said, we think of him as someone who, I mean, his pictures telegraph someone who's a loner and, you know, as we said, this lonely moon rising. But you're shaking your head no, Karen.
Yeah. No, he was an incredibly gregarious and very social person. Mm. He was also an incredibly funny man. And one of the things we were quite anxious was to get that across in showing a number of very witty and very humorous images by him, too.
What would one of the humorous ones be?
There's one that we particularly love being museum people, which is an image of a whole group of plaster casts in the basement of the de Young Museum, where he was doing a freelance job that looks like a sort of wacky family portrait, all these very odd-looking pieces of sculpture.
I'm also looking at one from 1967, the freeway interchange in Los Angeles. That's, I guess, one of his urban landscapes that I wouldn't have known that he did. But if you hold it far away, it looks like a tree.
It really does. And that is, I think, what really strikes us in looking at so many of the modern late works. They definitely take on natural forms.
Sandra Lane, I just want to ask you again. You have graciously lent these private, personal photographs to this tour that's going to start across the country. What's that like to let them go like that for a little while?
Difficult. Yeah. I miss them, especially Moonrise has usually been over my bed, and I think I'm the only person that knows it from the ground up, looking up.
Wait a minute. You're talking about the original Moonrise?
Yes.
The poster in just about
it's,
every...
Yes, it's being in Hernandez, New Mexico, and it has the crosses that have lights on them, and you can see forever, and there's the moon, and that's why it's called Moonrise.
And then there's a sort of a cloud bank below it.
Yes, it's very beautiful. It's mesmerizing.
And as you said, you see it from the ground up.
I see it from the ground up, and I said to him, I'm going to miss it. What am I going to do?
but lucky for us, you're willing to let them go.
Yes,
for a little
I
while.
Am, and I would do anything to have Ansel Adams' pictures be seen by more people and educate the young people of what beautiful art is all about.
Well, now they will be seen. Sandra Lane and her late husband William H. Lane have lent their private collection to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston for the new showing of Ansel Adams photographs, and it will start across the country. Check our website, here-now.org, to see what it's coming to, a museum near you. Sandra and Karen, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.